June 11th, 1970, Region 20 Regional Conference.
Hey, Joe Danz, you've done a good job. You can hear me if you'll just hush a little. I think we ought to get going. We have a rather crowded agenda, and although I know some of you are still eating, I think if you will eat quietly, the plastic tableware doesn't make much noise. We can get started because there are several items that we can handle right at the very beginning. I would like to, because he has a schedule that will not allow him to stay for the program, to introduce a friend of ours and a friend of yours. One of the fellows that the old timers here remember staying up late at night on election night during gubernatorial races to wonder whether we have won or not. And somehow, all the time that he ever ran for governor, even though they tried to count the margarine votes against him once, he came through. I'm very happy to have here to come up and say hello to you, the candidate for the Supreme Court of the state of Michigan, Governor Williams. Come on up, Soapy, say a word. Thank you very, very much, Bard Young, Leonard Woodcock, Fraser, Abel, Herb, and friends once, one and all. Well, it's a great honor and a privilege to be able to greet all of you here this evening and to express my appreciation for all that you have done for me in the past. I see that you've got a tremendous program going, so I'm not going to spend any time except to say God bless you. I know that you have a new president. I've watched him now in three or four meetings, and it really excites me to see the confidence that he evokes, because that spells well not only for the Union, but for the whole state and really for the whole country. Good luck to all of you.
As I indicated, we will try to keep all of the previous announcements to a minimum, but there are a few things we do have to report on. Paul Morris, where are you? On the grape boycott and a request, Paul Morris on our staff. Come on up, Paul.
You all have these leaflets which tells you about the grape rally tomorrow noon in Kennedy Square. If you're free, please be there. Cesar Chavez is going to be there. We had hoped we could have him here with us tonight, but he is in negotiations and he won't be arriving in the city until the wee small hours tomorrow morning. And then he's going to appear at the rally at Kennedy Square, where President Woodcock is going to present him with a truck which will be used to carry the Freedom Bell all around the country, the Freedom Bell symbolizing the farm workers' struggle. So we want you all to be there. Bring your friends, your family. If you can't get there, try to get somebody else to get there. Noon tomorrow at Kennedy Square. Now, in connection with the great boycott, you're doing a very good job. We're making progress. We've still got a long way to go, but we've got about 8 contracts now. You may have seen in this morning's paper, the newest contract is the biggest yet. 5,000 workers just signed up, and Chavez is working very hard, and you've all been helping. By way of a progress report, I want to let you know that you can now, tonight, go into Kroger's and buy Union label grapes. Here are some other firms which have ordered them. They'll be coming in soon. Chatham Supermarkets, Farmer Jacks. Farmer Jack has been with us all the way. Great Scott. Kroger. The only one that's still a question mark, the only major supermarket chain is A&P. Now, what's liable to happen is this. Some of these firms will get some Union Label grapes in. We're going to buy them and enjoy them. Then they're going to run out, some of them. So watch for that Union Label. And if it's not there, then go to where you can get Union Label grapes. Please do that. And be at the rally tomorrow at noon. See you there.
President Woodcock will be there tomorrow at noon, and the UAW will be presenting to Cesar Chavez a Chevy van. Prince Moon, where are you? Got to have a report on the summer school.
Thank you, Bart. July 5th, 1970, history will be made for Region 1E. I'm speaking primarily because this will be the first summer school that will be held at the Family Educational Center at the Black Lake area. For that reason, I think there are some things we should get, some information we'd like to get to you now. And first is, the applications we sent out to you are slowly coming in. And remember, June 14th is the final deadline. Now, I'm sure all of you are my friends, and you're going to call me on June 15th and says, look, can you get me one more guy in while I have a girl and a guy I like to put in? So let me warn you now. Try to get them in as soon as you possibly can so that we can get the administrative duties of the summer school together. Now, housing for the officers' day. It's almost impossible. Those officers that will be attending summer school, if you don't let us know prior to your coming that you will be there and whether or not you want accommodations for that night, we submit to you that as soon as you possibly can, let us know what officers will be attending on June 9th for the officers' day. July 9th. Thank God. The workshops, we also sent out a letter to you stating that as soon as you make the decision of who will be attending our summer schools, send in the first and second choices of your workshops. Now, some of you sent in this information, but we haven't seen your workshops. Now, if you don't tell us what workshops you want, then we're going to put you in a workshop that we think is best for you, and naturally, you're going to reap your wrath, but this we must do. Now, one thing we'd like to stress, even though this is not a musician union, we do have a number of musicians and talented people here that play the instrument. We're going to try at this time to put on a good summer school, but we need you people that are fluent in the field of music. That those of you have some musical talent, please bring your instruments with you. I mentioned this to Bard this morning. He said, can you imagine seeing a UAW guy coming with a piano on his back or in his truck? Well, we don't want to go to that extreme. But if you play any musical instrument, please bring it along with you. Now, there's some material out on the desk there. We hope that you will take it with you when you leave. Now, one last announcement, and that is about the Wayne State University Labor History Archives. They're now putting on a program there of an exhibition of more than 50,000 pictures and things that related to Walter Reuther in his lifetime as the president of his organization. At the Wayne State University Library, the library is open at 8 o'clock in the morning, and hopefully you will take advantage of these things, because I'm sure some of you might see some of your pictures along with Walter's there. Remember, please, get this information into us as soon as possible. Thank you.
Normally, we don't introduce people who are from small villages or cities around because our schedule doesn't permit it. I do want to introduce a man that I happen to believe epitomizes most of the kind of philosophies that the UAW has. Just recently, in a suburb of the city of Detroit downriver, there was a very serious problem as it related to the high school in River Rouge. I think that we can commend the mayor of this town for taking the kind of a position which brought that very serious confrontation to a conclusion, and which laid the groundwork for, certainly in that city, a greater relationship between the blacks and the whites. And I want to just have him stand up. I know he's here, and that's Mayor McEwen of River Rouge. Where are you, Mayor? Jim Doty, where are you? Jim will give a brief report on the cap dollar drive.
As most of you know, our cap drive started in Region 1E on June 1st. As of this moment, Local 157 is in the lead. They have already contributed to the region by $700. We also want you to know that this year, each staff individual is given at least six books, which is $60 worth of cap tickets. They're to sell them, but not in your local unions. They're to get management people, outside people, relatives. And the reason for this is we've did something a little different than we've done in other years as far as the cap drive is concerned. You all know that we have a combined cap drive with Region 1, 1A, 1B, and 1E. And the grand prize will be the choice of a Ford, Plymouth, Chevrolet, or an American Motors car. Then each region will give many more prizes, which will be duplicated in all of the other regions, such as a mini bike, a diamond ring, colored TV, black and white TV, and many more. But in order to make it so that our people would have some incentive other than just what the dollar is meant for, the regional director has come up with an idea that for every $60 that's turned into the region, we will get the name of the individual and the size for a windbreaker. And the windbreaker will be a white windbreaker with a black lettering of the UAW. And of course, the only other thing that you have to take along with the jacket is the emblem of Region 1E, Director Bard Young. And since he's giving the jacket, I think it's well worth the while for many of us to try to get out and do better than we've done in the past. We haven't done too bad as far as COPE is concerned, as it was called in the past, and now CAP, but we've fallen short from many of the other regions. I have contacted most of the officers within our region, and I've gotten much more cooperation than we have in the past. And I'm sure that if each of you will take the opportunity to just approach the members of your local union, that we will sell at least 80% or better of the membership. I said this at a meeting not too long ago, that many people will pick many excuses for not selling cap tickets. We found in some locals where there's a plant of 100 people and $2 comes back and the committee says it's hard to sell. When we check it out, we find that the committee didn't even buy tickets themselves. We then went into the local unions, and we found that the people inside had said that they had not been approached. Let's not have that kind of a rumor this time. Let's all put our shoulder to the wheel and go out and do an extra job, because we're going to need that money, because we certainly don't want people back in office that are now ruling the state of Michigan, such as Milligan. And we certainly need the money to put in an individual that we all know, and that's Phil Hart and G. Men and Williams. So with that, I hope that everybody gets behind it. And don't forget, we want to see everybody wearing a Region 1E white and black jacket. Thank you.
I wasn't going to spend very much time today commenting myself, but I think as it relates to the cap drive, there's a few things that I feel that we have to touch on. I'm sure that some of the speakers here will be doing that. I happen to have today a document called Human Events that is printed in Washington, D.C., which is one of the far-right publications that's being published all the time. They start out by, on the very top of their paper, by saying, "Let us send you a copy of Barry Goldwater's classic Conscience of a Conservative, plus 6 months of human events to a friend of your choice." The thing they say here is that despite the noise it is making, the liberal left is in disarray. The Democratic Party is broke and disorganized. Workers are defying their unions. Destiny has handed the conservatives an excellent chance this year to capitalize on this confusion on the left. Conservatives' main task in 70 should be to work for the defeat of liberals of both parties in this year's Senate and House races. Of those 27 seats occupied by senators with Americans for Constitutional Action, that's ACA, vote ratings under 50%, and 20 have ACA ratings, that's their ratings, of under 20%. Included are some of the Senate's most outspoken liberals: Hartke of Indiana, Muskie of Maine, Tidings of Maryland, Kennedy of Massachusetts, Hart of Michigan. Many of these men are considered highly vulnerable to defeat by conservative opponents. Ralph Yarbough has already lost to conservative Lloyd Benson. The defeat of only a few more liberals would greatly strengthen the Senate's conservative coalition. I raise that with you because if ever there's been a time when the opportunities for us to do our thing, it's today. I can remember speaking, and I know that Amel and many others spoke to local unions and to rallies that we held in Region 1E in 1968, and we predicted certain things would happen if we couldn't elect our people. Many of them have happened. But the interesting thing was that in 1968 we lost the governorship, although the state of Michigan, and I think through your good work, went for the Democratic nominee for president. We lost the gubernatorial race by 500,000 votes. One of the reasons that you know and I know is that many of our members had decided at this time that they really weren't part of what they would consider called the working class, that they had become the so-called silent majority and part of the affluent middle-class society. You know, you can always be part of the middle-class society at the point that you are concerned about the difference between a recession and a depression and a panic. And we had a panic once in this country. But somebody once said that there is a very simple way to explain the difference between the three. A recession is when your neighbor is laid off. A depression is when you're laid off. And a panic is when your wife is laid off. The simple thing is that we have everything going for us today. The guys that were concerned 2 years ago about the status quo are more concerned about it today because they have seen what's happened in the Nixon administration. When Nixon said the biggest job in this country is to stop inflation, and yet inflation, the cost of living increased in the first year of his administration farther than ever has in the history of this country, to a higher degree, and his crazy monetary policies has created a recession matched only by those under the Eisenhower administration, and nobody knows where it's going to end. I think guys who were once concerned 2 years ago about some things are concerned about what's going to happen, unemployment compensation. I think they're concerned about what's going to happen at the collective bargaining table. I think they're concerned about what's going to happen in Lansing, and concerned about what's going to happen in Congress. Sure, I think when the time comes and you go to the guy or the gal next to you on the line and ask her to donate a buck for CAP, you ought to start explaining the issues. And if you can't do it that way, that's when you sell them a chance on a car.
And nobody can kid me. I see raffles and plants time after time after time where 100% of the people, 100% of the people have bought tickets on a car or upon any other kind of a raffle. I don't like to sell a ticket on that basis, but do it if you have to because the dollars are needed. Just remember that that portion of the per capita taxes of a local union goes into CAP can never be used to elect any federal official of any kind. It can't be used for a congressman election. It cannot be used for a senator's election. And it just so happens that the Democratic Party in the state of Michigan is broke. I think Senator Hart will win. Senator Hart will not beat Lenore Romney if he cannot get on television, and he can't get there unless we furnish some dollars. And the only way we're going to furnish them is if you will do the job that you're capable of doing. So I say to you, I had to spend this opportunity of saying the books are there. The opportunity is there. And I'd like to see Region 1E lead all four of the Detroit regions in the kind of a job they can do in collecting dollars. I remember, and our good friends are here from Cadillac, but when Emil Mazie and I stood out there one morning, and it was raining, and it was miserable, and it was cold, trying to sell, when the guys were coming to work, trying to sell cap tickets, he sold $4 worth, I sold two. But the point that's being made is, I think there's a different reaction today. 2 years ago, we didn't have that reaction. And I think that our membership is more aware of the problems that they are faced with individually. There are many people that have said that sometimes you have to have a recession or a depression to bring people back into the organization and back into the party, and maybe it's true. I don't think we ought to let it go any farther than it is, and we ought to start to fight. And the way we fight this one, to begin with, is with dollars. A couple of other quick announcements. Pete McMahon, who is the financial secretary of this local union, who is always so kind to us in giving us this beautiful hall of theirs for our conferences, will be retiring. And we're having a retirement party right here in this hall on Friday, June 26th at 6:30 in the evening. The tickets are $7.50. Cocktails at 6:30, dinner at 7:30. Joe Dans or anybody else has got tickets here, and if any of you fellows want to, or gals, it'll be a good party, you can believe that. Paul Silver also has a retirement party. That's on Tuesday, June the 30th at Roma Hall. And that's at 6:30. And I think Grace has got some tickets, or some of the girls back at those tables. I think it's particularly appropriate right now. I've waited until this time because I wanted everybody to be seated and have some quiet. This is the first regional conference since before our convention. Some of you have had membership meetings or have been somewhere where appropriate silence was given, but some of you haven't. And I think it would be perfectly appropriate now that we stand in a moment's of silence for our departed President Walter Reuther. Now introduce a particular friend of the membership of Region 1E who has been to many of our regional conferences to talk to our leadership about issues facing our union, and who very recently had the unhappy job of becoming acting president of the UAW during the period in which, following the sad death of President Reuther. I would attribute to him, and of course to the other fellows that are sitting here, but particularly to him, that it was his influence and his help that kept this union together in some of the most trying circumstances that we've had since we were formed. And I know that all of them, the other officers and friends sitting here, join me in saying, we're glad to have you back, Emil Mazie. Come on up.
Thank you very much, Bard Young, President Woodcock, Vice President Fraser, the sisters and brothers. I want to apologize at this time for my inability to table hop this evening. I've been walking on one foot for about a week. And Monday was the first chance I had to see a doctor, and he told me I had the gout. I told him that was impossible. I wasn't making enough money. But I've got it anyhow, and it's very painful for me to stand. And so if I don't walk around the tables as I usually do at these meetings, when the meeting is over, I'm not mad at anybody, but I just can't stand on this foot too long. 4 weeks ago, last Saturday evening, Walter Mayreuther, Bill Wolfman, Waller's security officer, and Oscar Stanaroff, our architect, were killed in a plane crash in Pellston, Michigan. But that tragic event that created a number of problems for us, and it also gave us an opportunity of thinking about our associations with one another. I first met Walter Reuther on Christmas Eve in 1936 at the IMA Hall on Michigan Avenue, when I had the opportunity of chairing the strike settlement meeting for the first contract at Kelsey Hayes. And I can recall vividly the first impression I had of Walter. When he found out I was the chairman, he came over to me and said, "Here's how I'd like to have you introduce me at the meeting this evening." He said, "I want you to be sure and tell the workers that I'm president of the West Side Local 174 and that I am also a member of the International Executive Board." And I recall my impression at the moment. I thought, well, here's a young man who knows where he's going. I first met Mayreuther, Walter's wife, during the Briggs strike in 1933, during the month of March of that year. My father was on strike at Briggs, and I was a 19-year-old leader of an unemployed movement in Detroit known as the Unemployed Citizens League. And I played a role in that strike. Like one evening, I went to a dance. I was being called by the IWW group, that's the Wobblies. And the dance was being held to raise money for the Briggs strikers. And I met Mayreuther at that dance. And she had taken off 2 weeks as a school teacher to try to raise money for the Briggs strikers. And as recently as 2 months ago, Walter Reuther, in one of his speeches, mentioned the fact that if May had continued to work and contributed her 2 weeks' salary to the strike, she would have doubled the amount of money she collected during the 2 weeks she took off. May was a great humanitarian. She had the same social ideals and philosophy as Walter, and they made a very fine team. I worked with Walter Reuther for more than 33 years. Walter was an able organizer. He was a great negotiator. He had the ability
to put a contract together that met the needs of all of the various groups inside our union. The needs of the production worker, the needs of the skilled trade worker, the needs of the women workers, the needs of the foundry workers, the needs of the young worker, the needs of the older worker. And he was a master at bringing a negotiation session to an end. Because when you're, the job of putting a contract together is not easy, but Walter was a master at this task. And he was a great and articulate spokesman for our union in all of the causes that we have supported. He's probably the most effective spokesman that the labor movement of our country has ever had. But I believe that if I were to make a selection of the great things that Walter did in his lifetime, that I believe that his greatest contribution to our union was unifying our union and keeping it unified. I went through the factional fights in our union, 1937-39 factional fight, when the then President Homer Martin betrayed our union when he sold out to the Ford Motor Company for a brand new, fully furnished house in Plymouth, Michigan, and he took part of our union to the American Separation of Labor and formed another organization. I went through the factional fights of the 40s, that was finally ended in 1947 when our administration became the majority in this union. And under Walter's leadership, we put the union together and we have kept the union together. Walter recognized the fact that a union to be effective at the bargaining table had to be united. That you do not have any power at the bargaining table if you have division in your leadership and if you have division in your ranks. And if you take a look at the progress that we made, when our union was first chartered on August 26, 1935, 35 years ago, up to 1947, and then measure the progress from 47 to the present time, there just isn't any comparison. And I know that there are a lot of factors that made the greater gains possible after 47, but I believe that one of the important ingredients that made greater progress possible was the fact that we had a united union. And therefore, following the death of Walter, on the evening of May the 9th, I gave a lot of consideration and thought as to where our union was going. And I realized that the primary thing that we had to do was to select our new leadership without dividing our union. And I'm very happy to be able to tell you this evening that we did exactly that. We have a united leadership. And I'm certain that we have a solidarity in our ranks from our members as well. We had several able and talented, experienced leaders in our union who could have made good and perhaps great presidents of our organization. But we only had two aspirants for the presidency. My good friend Doug Fraser, vice president of our union, director of our Chrysler and skilled trade departments, and Vice President Leonard Woodcock, who was director of our General Motors and Aerospace Department. And I knew that when I began to meet with our leadership on an individual basis to try to obtain a consensus, that both Doug Fraser and both Leonard Woodcock would have made great presidents of our union. The consensus favored Leonard Woodcock, and when I met with the Doug Fraser and advised him of the outcome of my consultation with the leadership of our union, he accepted the decision gracefully. He pledged his full support and his talents to assist the President Woodcock and then on the following day, on the Thursday following the memorial services we had for Walter, Doug made his public announcement, withdrawing from the race, announcing his support for Leonard Woodcock. Here was a fine demonstration of dedication and devotion to our union and the action on part of Doug Fraser made our job much simpler. President Woodcock will make a great president for our union. I have worked with Leonard for more than 33 years. He's an experienced bargainer. He has the right social philosophy. And he has my full support in making certain that we fulfill all of the obligations and the responsibilities of his office. And I know that Brother Woodcock will have the full support of our local union leadership and the full support of our members. The newspapers in the days following the tragic death of Walter carried stories, and some of the television stations carried stories. They're talking about a division in our union. They were talking about a power fight in our union. They're talking about the bitterness developing in our organization. And I think some of them privately were hoping that we might have a split and division inside our organization. And I'm very happy to be able to say to you tonight that there hasn't been a power struggle in our organization. There is no division in our union. There is no bitterness in our organization. We have teamwork in the leadership of our organization, and we're going to continue to have teamwork in the leadership of our organization. I appeared on a number of television shows during these very crucial periods, and the one question that kept being raised time and time again was the direction in which our union was going. Reporters wanted to know, will we follow the collective bargaining goals and objectives that Walter Reuther so effectively expressed for all of us? And my answer to that question and my answer tonight is yes, we will follow those objectives, because first of all, they were accepted by the delegates to our last convention by some 3,170 delegates. And that these programs were not programs of Walter Reuther's alone. They were programs of Leonard Woodcock, of Doug Fraser, of Barg Young, of Emil Mazey, and the balance of the leadership of our union. And we're going to do everything we can to aggressively and effectively carry forth to win at the bargaining table, the same as Walter Reuther would have done. Some of the people on the outside looking at our union have never understood the UAW. We have not been a monolithic organization. We have had a union where we have had collective leadership in developing our programs and our policies. And we will continue to have that collective leadership. On the matter of social programs, we will follow the same social objectives that President Reuther believed in so greatly, because we have the same commitment to the fulfillment of those programs as did Walter Reuther. And we will redouble our efforts and increase our activity to end second-class citizenship in our country and to win equal rights and equal opportunities in every facet of our life for all of our citizens, regardless of the color of their skin, their nationality, their religion, their sex, or any other consideration. We will vigorously fight the ugly practices of segregation and discrimination wherever and whenever it raises its ugly head. And on the federal front, we will fight for decent housing. We will fight for proper and equal education for every child in our country. We will fight to bring Walter's dream for a national health law that will provide medical care for every person without consideration to his economic status. And we will fight to give every person in our country an opportunity for a decent job and to end the problems of unemployment that periodically plague us in our nation. And we will intensify our fight for peace. We will do everything we can. And we will do everything we can to implement President Ruther's last message that he sent to the President Nixon, asking him to pull out of Cambodia and pull out of Vietnam and end that damn dirty war as fast as possible. We must end the slaughter of our young men in that worthless fight. We must bring our men home while they're still alive. And the $30 billion a year that we're spending to help protect a military dictatorship in South Vietnam could better be used to meet our domestic problems right here at home. And we're going to do everything we can to get our members to understand what's involved in this war and to seek their support to elect senators and congressmen and others who have a means of bringing about peace in Vietnam and peace in other parts of the world. 1970 is a year of tremendous challenge and opportunity. We have our collective bargaining challenges, and President Woodcock will talk about that in some detail. We have important elections this year. We have 435 members of the House of Representatives who are up for election. And we have to elect more liberals to the House of Representatives if we expect to have the proper kind of social legislation passed by our Congress. We have 35 senators up for election, including our own Senator Philip Hart. And as Bard has said so well, we have to raise money to support candidates seeking federal office so that we can return Phil Hart to the U.S. Senate, the largest vote margin that any candidate in our state has ever had, elect more congressmen in our state. And then we have the job of picking a governor in our state and picking a state legislature, as we do in a number of states throughout the country. Now, I believe that all of us have to work together to make sure that our collective bargaining objectives come out right. We have to work together for the benefit of our membership, for our benefit, and I think we ought to do it for one other reason. I'm sure that Walter Ruther would not think much of a bronze statue of himself as a memorial from the members of our union. But I'm sure that Walter would feel very good if all of us worked together to make certain that we succeeded in achieving our collective bargaining goals, which were also his goals. So let's do it for our membership. Let's do it for ourselves, and let's also do it in the memory of Walter Ruther. And on the political front, we have the job and the responsibility of getting our people registered, of getting them acquainted with the issues and the policies and the programs that we're pursuing. They have to know the voting records of the candidates that we support as well as those that we oppose. We have to raise dollars. Let's do it for our membership. Let's do it for ourselves. And let's do it for Walter Reuther. And I'm sure that if all of us work together, if we demonstrate the dedication and devotion that Walter had given to our movement for all these many years, that under the leadership of our new president, Leonard Woodcock, that 1970 can be a banner year at the collective bargaining table, can be a banner year in the political arena, and we can march ahead with our heads high, knowing that we've done a good job in advancing the cause of our membership, in advancing the cause of the people of our country. I call for your support before these programs. I ask you to work harder than you've ever worked before in making certain that our union keeps united so that we can do the job for the purposes for which our union was established. Thank you very much.
Roy, you don't have to stop taping just because your boss has finished speaking. I want to digress for just a minute off of our program just to introduce somebody that I'd like to have some of you meet. You'll stand up and take a bow. This young man announced that quite some time ago that he was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of the state of Michigan. Very decent young fellow. He's waging a vigorous campaign. Many of you met him in Atlantic City because I invited him to come down and meet the delegates, and he came to Atlantic City and he attended at all of the different parties in the different regions, and many of you had the chance to see him and shake his hand. And you'll have a chance, I'm sure, to see him again. Stand up and take a bow, Sandy Levin. Next fellow I want to introduce is certainly no stranger to Region 1E. He was once a director. And he has acquitted himself so well since he became a vice president in the kind of assignments that he had in Chrysler, in skilled trades, where many of us remember that not too long ago our union was under attack by outside forces. But I think maybe the key to the kind of a character that this fellow has is the fact that he said, "I would like to be president." But he also said, when the consensus indicated that he was not the will of the majority of the executive board, he said, "Our union is in good hands. We don't have to worry. With my friend," and he was and is, "Leonard Woodcock as president, and I withdraw on his behalf, and I give you not necessarily just the vice president of the International Union, but once a regional director of Region 1E, and that's Doug Fraser."
Thank you very much, Bard, Leonard, Namel, brothers and sisters of Region 1E. It's hard to realize that it's not yet 5 weeks since the tragic death of Walter and May Reuther. To many of us, it seems almost a lifetime. And last week, we held our first meeting of the International Executive Board that Walter didn't share, at least in my experience there. 20 years, 8 years as administrative assistant of Walter and 12 years as an elected member of the International Executive Board. And obviously we all missed him because he was the most unusual man. He was really an irreplaceable man. He's a man of almost unlimited capacity. He was a brilliant man. And through him, because I worked for him, not because of me, I met the great and the near great of this country and other countries. And I never saw anyone that could match him for pure intellectual capacity. He's a great negotiator because he was a great tactician. And he has that essential element that you needed in negotiation, a great sense of timing. And we shall miss him. But I think one of his greatest attributes was that the greater the crisis, the more ready was his response. The more trouble we were in, his adrenaline just seemed to flow. And he was better with each difficult situation. The more difficult the situation was, the better Walter was. And it seems to me that he has a right to expect of all of us that in our hour of difficulty, we should be better than we usually are, or better than we were. And I can tell you that I think this process has started in our union. As I indicated last week, we had a meeting of the International Executive Board, and Bard will tell you, it's his first meeting as Leonard as chairman. That was certainly one of the most constructive executive board meetings that I've ever sat through in my whole 20 years experience. We did an awful lot of work. We come to grips and solve some very, very difficult problems and start thinking about the problems that lie ahead. And when I walked away from that board meeting on Friday, I felt, and I'm sure I speak the sentiments of the entire executive board, that under Leonard's chairmanship, we had a great week for our union. I just want to make one reference, because I know Leonard is going to talk about the role that Emil Mazey played during this difficult transition period. I'm just going to say that he did a masterful job, and I share the sentiments expressed by Bard and share the feelings and subscribe to the words that Leonard is going to give you relative to Emil Mazey. Now, Leonard Woodcock is a man of tremendous talent and great dedication. As Bard says, he is a friend of mine. And seeing that he's president and I'm now vice president, this is not a bad relationship, especially if I come to him and want another staff member. As I say, everyone really has to be their own man. Everyone has to behave and act according to their own personality. And as I've been saying, that the presidency of our union will change in style, but it won't change in philosophy. And I can underscore what Bard says, the presidency and the office of the presidency of your union is in good hands. Walter Reuther was the spiritual leader of our union. But as Emil says, the total International Executive Board shared that philosophy. Oh, we would argue perhaps about how you implement the program or the timing of the implementation of the program, but the basic philosophy of our union was shared by all. And the people who comment and write about our union that say we're now going to change direction or we're now going to withdraw from our commitments or we won't continue our fight for social justice or we'll make a more modest approach to the bargaining table just don't understand us. Because the spirit of our union is not the International Executive Board or Solidarity House. The spirit of our union is people like Dave Miller, over 80 years of age, delivering that beautiful, eloquent eulogy for Walter Reuther. The spirit of our union is the spirit contained in this hall and all the meetings that we're having throughout the country. That's the spirit of our union. And that is why that when we go to the bargaining table this year, if the employers take any comfort out of our tragedy, they're making the biggest mistake in their life. Because we ought to start telling from General Motors, the largest corporation, to the smallest company in Region 1E, that we're going to march to the bargaining table in 1970 with greater determination than we've ever had before. And if we are forced to fight the 1970, then whoever the corporation is, they're going to take on and have to fight a union that's more united than it's ever been before. And when we walk away from that bargaining table in 1970, we're going to have earlier retirement. We're going to have improved cost of living clause. We're going to have a substantial wage increase. We're going to have many of the things that Walter and the delegates talked about in the month of May in Atlantic City. But this is not a responsibility that Leonard Woodcock has to shoulder alone. It's a responsibility, a joint responsibility that all of us have to help in. And this goes particularly to the local union leadership, because we can't do it ourselves. As I said many, many times, the greatest unsolved problem confronting our international union or any mass organization is the inability of a mass organization of 1,600,000 members, that inability to have direct communication from the leadership to the membership. That the only way we can really communicate is communicate with the secondary leadership, the local union leadership, through the staff people, through meetings such as this. Because you're the only people that have access to the membership, hour in and hour out, and day in and day out, and week in and week out. And it's up to you to carry the gospel, to preach the program, the collective bargaining program, and the social program, and that's the way it's done. And we also know that in any hour of crisis, any time we've been in a struggle with a corporation, our membership is a great membership, and they'll respond. But they don't come to membership meetings month in and month out. You know that. Leonard could go to every membership meeting in Region 1E and for the whole year, and at the end of that year, he won't have talked to more than 5% of the membership. And we shouldn't be so critical about this, because we changed our constitution at the last convention because we realized this problem. And let's be frank about it, a membership meeting, when you hear the report of the financial secretary in the minutes of the previous meeting, is hardly an exciting, stimulating experience. So it's only in a time of crisis that the membership shows. And you try to increase the dues or change the seniority system or do some other radical thing, and the membership will pack your hall to the overflow. And as I said the other day at a meeting that I was president of my local union, I think when I was 25 or 26 years old, and the membership meetings start falling off, the days of excitement were gone. And it got smaller, and we were having very small membership meetings, and the chairman of our educational committee says, well, the problem is that the meetings are too routine, that we ought to have some social activity. And what we ought to do is have beer at a membership meeting. And so I was young and impressionable, and I says, all right, we'll have refreshments and we'll have beer at the membership meetings from now on. So instead of having just small membership meetings, we had small drunken membership meetings. But our union is great because we do have a great secondary leadership. There's no end to the skill and the talent and the dedication of our local union leadership. And there's no end to their ingenuity. And I was saying that Monday of this week, we called a meeting of our International Negotiating Committee. It's international in Chrysler because Chrysler is also under the international agreement. And Charlie Brooks is the president of Local 444 in Canada. It's a big local union of some 12,000 members. And they're having elections next week, and his opponent put out a leaflet. And he attacks Charlie. This is the leaflet. He attacks Charlie Brooks, telling him that he hadn't done a very good job as the incumbent president. And then his opponent had a four-point program. And the first point was that, and this is what the leaflet says, more breaks and shorter hours, so that the worker can give his wife the affection that she needs. And then the second point was, beer machines installed in the plant and the beer shall be sold at cost. And then the third point was, full-time minister and chaplain in the plant, so that worker who is in trouble can have his personal problem attended to immediately. And then the fourth point was, time off for any time of day or any time during the week without giving the company any excuse or any proof of their absence. So I said to Charlie, I says, Charlie, that sounds like a pretty attractive program, this four-point program. He says, oh, I don't think it's so great. He says he's only advocating four things. Number one, he wants affection. Number two, he wants infection. Number three, he wants redemption. And number four, he wants exemption. But going into 1970, our success is really going to be dependent upon our ability to mobilize the membership, and that's your task along with ourselves. And Waller was always fond of saying that you can make the best economic arguments in the world, you can have all of the economics arguments on your side, and you can deliver them in the most eloquent fashion, but that won't get you anywhere at the bargaining table unless you're prepared to fight. And it's so true. Waller's eloquence was, he was able to rally and mobilize the membership, and certainly he was able to mobilize and gain the support of public opinion. But at the bargaining table, he's absolutely right. And I was talking the other day about 1964 when we set the pattern in Chrysler. And that was a pretty good year. We got the $400 a month pension. We got the premiums paid for the retirees for hospital medical insurance. We negotiated for the first time the bridge and transition benefit, negotiated bereavement pay for the first time, negotiated paid absence allowance the first time in automobile industry, then negotiated relief time, additional relief time, the first time in the big three that we'd been able to get an improvement since the inception of our union. But I know how we won them. About 3 o'clock in the morning, and we had about 11 o'clock deadline, we got permission from the negotiating committee to break down to a smaller committee, three on each side. There's a big conference room that some of you are familiar with out at Highland Park at the Chrysler Corporation. There sat just the six of us, three on our side, three on the company side. And the company was saying we will only agree to $300 a month and 60%, and we were pressing for $400 and 70%. And after we both sides had exhausted all of the arguments, a silence fell over the room. I didn't say anything to Waller. We didn't say anything to the company. They didn't say anything to each other. And I don't know how many minutes went by, but there was absolute and total silence in that room, and you could feel the pressure building up. And finally, John Leary, the vice president of Chrysler, who was not the most brilliant negotiator in the world, in fact, he's fairly stupid, broke the silence by saying, my God, let's do something, let's say something, we're running out of time, we're going to have a strike. Then we knew we had them, we made the settlement. Well, that was the eloquence of the power that we had. And it wasn't Waller Ruther's eloquence, it wasn't anything I said, it was the absolute silence and that pressure that was building up. And it built up because we knew we had the support of the Chrysler workers, and we knew we had the support of the General Motors workers, the Ford workers, and the workers in the parts industry. We knew we had the support of the total union. And so I say to you that if you can give in 1970 Leonard Woodcock that same support that you gave to us in 1964, 1970 will be a year of accomplishment. It will be a year of achievement. It will be a year of great gains for the members of our union. It'll be a year of progress, a year where we can say to each other at the end of the negotiations that we've taken care of the most pressing problems confronting the membership that we're privileged to represent. So this union is going to advance, and it's going to go forward, and it's going to go march on and on and on. Thank you very much.
In spite of anything that Doug Fraser said, we're going to have beer after the meeting.
We have a drunken big meeting.
So he says we may have a drunken big meeting. I want to make this comment in introducing the president of our union. You know, tragedy does many things to both people and organizations. They either get worse or they get better. It may not sound right to some people, but I think it's true. As a result of a tragedy, we're going to be a better union. We're going to be better because I think all of us are going to be better. All of us are going to work harder. It was quite apparent to me at the board meeting we recently had in Black Lake. Our board is a better board today than it was before. I don't think any group of people can sit together year after year, as has happened on our International Executive Board, that little differences and little petty things sometimes bother them. But it was so obvious and so apparent that those things aren't there now. The United Mine Workers has never been a strong union since John L. Lewis died and since he left the presidency, because they were a complete monolithic organization. It was a union of one man who had the support of the membership. And we haven't been a monolithic organization. As Emil spelled out here, our demands and our policies were never fixed by one person. And many of us sitting here have disagreed with a policy and hammered it out and found that we changed policies from time to time as a result of this discussion. And somebody said, and said it so well and eloquently, on the executive board when we were drying our tears, that our union had suffered an irreparable loss, but not an irreplaceable loss. In January of 1968, right here in this hall, we had the opportunity, most of us here, of hearing then the Vice President Woodcock come to us during a dinner break in which the 5-day letters had been given to the General Motors Corporation. And he came here and gave us a report.